Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is February 8th, 2016. We're convened for the purposes of receiving invited testimony from the Department of Corrections and others regarding staffing levels. We will do a work session on the Department of Corrections Prison Population and Status Report, and then we'll have an informational meeting regarding Deer Ridge Correctional Institution. Linda, anything that you should tee up for us?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the subcommittee, you have teed up pretty much everything. The invited testimony includes at least six people that I know of. I don't think we have any other ones. And without further ado, I think we can invite Director Peters to the table.
Okay. Director Peters.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. I'm going to figure out how to pull up this PowerPoint.
Fix this. Why are you doing some transgenders?
Now that. That is outside of the box.
Oh, okay. One second. Just throwing it out there.
Is it uploaded on here, Linda?
It's on OLIS.
OLIS.
Perfect, thank you. So as that is pulling up, as Co-Chair Shields mentioned, I have the pleasure of spending the afternoon with you talking about a variety of things. And for the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. First, I will share with you our staffing levels. And as you pointed out, I am not here alone today. So we have both representatives from AFSCME and AOCE. So I'm proud to have them in the audience with us today. And at the request of the committee, we wanted to have a conversation around staffing levels, but we'll also talk about our population report this afternoon, our request around Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, and our behavioral health unit.
Thanks, Marie.
Starting with our staffing levels, I'll start with a historical overview. First, I want to point out some terms. You will notice that we use the term adult in custody interchangeable with inmate. I've had a long philosophical conversation with you about why that is, but I'll save that for another day. But when you see AIC on this slide, that is what we are referring to. As you can see from these graphs, over time, the ratio of adults in custody to staff has risen since the 2007-2009 biennium. But please look at the slide closely, because we actually have it backwards in the title. In the title, it says staff to AIC ratio, and it actually should read AIC to staff ratio. I'll also point out that most graphs going up means it's a good thing. That's not the case with this graph. What this graph is showing you, in fact, is that our security staff have progressively supervised a greater number of inmates. If the ratio of AICs to staff that we experienced in the 2007 and 2009 biennium was applied to the inmate population that we have today, in 15-17, we would actually have over 2,900 FTE rather than the 2,500 FTE that we have today. And I certainly wouldn't even argue that we have the appropriate ratio even back in 2007-2009. You can see that there was a spike in the population in 2005-2007 and a drop again in 2009 and 2011. For security staff, that's just reflective of DRCI opening up, you granting us FTE authority, and then us not hiring those individuals because we didn't open up the medium at Deer Ridge. Now, staffing also dropped from 1113. Excuse me, in 1113. And that was for two reasons. One, that's when we mothballed the Oregon State Penitentiary minimum. And two, that's when the state engaged in some pretty significant management reductions, and that included the elimination of one lieutenant position from each of our minimum institutions. So that's what that drop reflects. Now, I would also argue that this is all security staff, all posts, 24/7. So what this slide doesn't represent is the actual supervision of inmates. So if you look at the ratio and you have on the slide 5.2 to 5.8 adults in custody for every staff member, you would think that that looks okay. What you would actually see when you walk into our institutions, because we're talking about every post and a 24/7 shift, is that you have one officer on a unit with 128 inmates. Or in some of our older institutions, what you would have if you walked on E block at the Penn is well over 400 inmates with two officers on that unit. So I think when you all tour our facilities, that's kind of the shocking representation that you see that isn't necessarily reflected in that slide.
Listen. Director, you just said that in the newer facilities it's 1 to 128, and in the old ones it's 2 to 400. How do we get to 5? That's a lot of people not in the cells.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Wisnant, as you're thinking about E-Block, and I don't know if you've visited the state penitentiary, but E-Block looks very much like those old prison movies that you would see where there's the four tiers going all the way up. And essentially the staffing pattern that we have is you would have one officer in the box being able to pull the locks and let the inmates flow to and from out of their cells. And then you have another officer walking the tiers looking to ensure that those that are in the cells are actually safe. And so it really is a structural issue, Representative Wisnant. We've learned over time that there are better ways to build prisons, there's better ways to create line of sight. Yet, I would still argue that even that ratio on the one officer to 128 inmates, that includes temporary and emergency beds that we didn't even have 5 years ago, so that number's even bigger than it was even 5 years ago.
So, Mr. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
But I'm still, if we're going to get down to 5.2 or 5.0, but I guess that's one per shift. We have three shifts?
One per shift, excuse me, Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Wisnant, one per shift that includes my relief factor, so vacation, sick leave, military leave, all of that leave, which we'll get to in more detail here in a minute. So it's very complex.
Representative Rayfield.
I was kind of curious for the various facilities, what is the industry standard or the ratio that, I mean, you'd want to see if we're looking at across the industry?
Co-chairs, Representative Rayfield, we have looked, and because each prison is so different in its construction, there is no industry standard. However, I will talk about here in a minute a review that we had from some national partners who came in and helped us try to normalize this conversation a little bit.
And then one follow-up?
Yeah.
And then as far as the ratios we're seeing those, you know, increase, I mean, what does that do for staff safety? Have you seen actual tangible evidence of staff safety issues?
Co-chairs, specifically Representative Rayfield, my team is amazing. I will tell you that we have actually seen assaults stabilize inside our organization. So if you actually look at the data points, you're actually seeing improvements to the safety and security of our prisons. That is not because of the supervision rates. It's because of other programs we've put in place around supervision, allowing our officers to be actually more empowered to hold offenders accountable right there and then for lower level offenses as opposed to having to go through the hearing process. So I think our officers have created an environment that has created safer and secure prisons. What I will tell you is the stress level has not dropped for them. So this whole notion that they're in this state of hypervigilance all of the time, that's only increased when you're by yourself and when you're solely responsible for those 128 individuals or over 400 individuals that lie before you in a unit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question for you in terms of that newer facilities with the 1 to 128 ratio and the olders to 400. Is there a difference, to kind of dovetail on Representative Rayfield, is there a difference in terms of assaults and other disruptions between those two types of operations in terms of the statistics?
Co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, I'd have to look specifically at the numbers, but I've never seen anything alarming come across my desk as we're looking at trends and assaults to suggest that there are more assaults in one institution than the other. What I can say is the culture is just very different at each one of our institutions. You can feel it when you walk in. It's hard to describe. The Oregon State Penitentiary has been around, as you know, for quite some time, almost 150 years, I believe. And that culture is just very different in terms of how that institution is run. And so it's hard truly to compare apples to apples because of structure, line of sight, and also those culture issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
A quick comment, a question to the director. I had the pleasure of spending 3 days last year going to Eastern Oregon and to Ontario and looking at these facilities. First, I was really impressed by the people working here. Amazing people. I don't know how they do it. It is really a tough job. A lot of times, what little hair I had on my head was sort of standing up in the back of my head. As you walk onto those floors with a couple hundred people, or you're there when they're going in to eat, and you have two or three officers there, I mean, if these people really want to cause a problem, those officers are at real risk. I mean, they lock it down and get it under control, but they're at real risk. I don't know what the national ratios are. These are, to me, just as an outsider rookie, I thought they were too low. But that said, that was something I was very concerned about. The other thing I was concerned about, and I've expressed to the director, I'd like to have her comment on it, is one, what are our overtime costs because of illness from all the stress, people going on vacation? Do you get to take your vacation? Those kind of things happening or not happening, and I'm hoping you're going to address that later in the discussion. And then my sort of pet peeve that she'll probably throw that container at me for. I think we have to seriously consider putting money in enough of those prisons that you have cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of places. You have a line of sight, and then off to the wings you can't see. And these are old buildings, especially in Pendleton and some other places. And I don't know what could go on out there. Probably nothing is going on now. But that line of sight problem for people trying to monitor, I think, is a real issue. Putting the cameras up is probably not a big cost. Getting the monitors and watch, it's going to be a lot more money. I just want to put that out on the table. It's something we should at least consider and be talking about the next few years. I think it'll help safety in the prisons. And I know they'd like to do it if they had the money. It's a question of coming up with enough cash to do that. So I'll stop there and let you answer the question about overtime, if you would. And thank you for your time.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, thank you for your comments. I will talk about overtime here in just a minute, so I'll address the camera issue. You are absolutely correct. We know that we need additional cameras. From a cost perspective, cameras aren't the issue. It's the storage space for the digital data. That's where the costs really go up. And so we have put policy option packages forward again and again, year after year, specifically as it relates to PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. We know that in order to comply with that standard alone, we need additional prisons. Excuse me, not additional cameras. Prisons, for the record, additional cameras in order to comply with that standard. So that is a request that will come forward again this next budget development cycle. Thank you. So as it relates to the outdated post-relief factor, the rising inmate population is the most obvious factor impacting our staffing levels. There is that second critical issue which we have faced, and that's our outdated post-relief factor. That's something that has not been readjusted since the mid-90s. The post-relief factor is a calculation we use to accurately project security staffing requirements for our facilities. It is the ratio between the number of hours a post must be filled to provide that necessary supervision of inmate activities and the number of employee hours available to fill each post. So that's the complexities around our staffing patterns. Until this biennium, the relief factor had not been updated since 1995, and I'll go into that in just a bit. It was updated this last biennium because you all, thankfully, approved an additional 33 positions to help us with our overtime issue. One critical piece to this is that we have fixed post obligations. We have posts that must be filled every day, three shifts a day, 24/7. The work of these posts are not optional. It has to get done, meaning these posts have to be staffed regardless of circumstances. The operations division, the division responsible for all of prison operations, contains about 73% of the agency's total workforce. So this is really one of our major budget drivers, which I know you all intimately understand. Since 1995, since we've updated those post relief factors in 1995, there have been so many things that have changed to affect the numbers of hours an employee is available to be on post. These changes, as you can see from the slide, whether from labor agreements through the collective bargaining process or state and federal legislation or DOC policy decisions, these all have widened the gap between the factors that were calculated in that 1995 post relief factor and our situation today. So I mentioned earlier that there was a national audit that occurred here at the Department of Corrections, but there are actually two analyses that I would like to discuss today that have been fairly recently completed on our post-relief factor. The first was in 2012 by then Secretary of State Kate Brown, who released a report on managing security personnel costs within the Department of Corrections. The objective of that audit was to determine if the agency could reduce personnel costs through better administrative processes and practices. The audit found that security personnel costs were actually generally well managed, so that was the good news, and there were no substantial inefficiencies in the management of overtime or personnel costs at the facilities that were audited. The audit concluded that the post-relief factor of 1.7 was appropriate based on average staff availability and the department's approved budget. Now, I'm going to disagree with the audit a little bit. Now that the Secretary of State is my boss, I don't know that that's really a great idea, but I'm going to disagree with the audit a little bit and hear why. We believe that it's just a little bit more complex than that. The relief factor calculation in the audit included actual vacation hours taken rather than accrued vacation hours. And I think that's really important to note, because while my staff do not burn all of their vacation every year, they have every right to do so. And so it's important to note that security staff can bid all of the vacation hours in which they are entitled, and a 1.7 relief factor would not allow us to manage that if that were to occur. In addition, the relief factor that they used in the Secretary of State audit report for in-service training, they included the actual hours of in-service training we were having that year, which because of budget reductions was down to 25, where we now are, in the last 2 years, are back to the 40 hours of in-service leave, and that relief factor didn't take that into account. I would also argue that I don't believe that even 40 hours is sufficient for public safety officials and does not compare to other public safety officers in the state of Oregon. Second, at our request, we requested the Association of State Correctional Administrators. So that's an association I belong to. That's all of my peers from across the country. We asked that they come in and complete a security staffing analysis of all of our 14 correctional institutions and our transport unit, so we could actually do, as the committee was asking, figure out how do we find that industry standard, how do we figure out how we compare to other agencies, and what really is best practices in terms of staffing. The primary goal of that analysis was to provide DOC with that thorough, comprehensive, objective assessment of security staffing of our facilities, and then also to provide us with recommendations that would enable us to perform security operations, as the Secretary of State audit suggested, in the most effective, efficient, and uniform manner, while still, of course, preserving our mission. Ensuring staffing levels and posts are consistent with DOC's mission was, of course, our paramount concern and directive to this audit team. ASCA deployed a team of six individuals. They visited all of our DOC facilities. They actually observed operations. They reviewed data. They interviewed our staff. And they reviewed all of our policies and procedures. During ASCA's evaluation, they determined what relief factor was needed to more effectively control overtime. That was one of our hopes. In their evaluation, ASCA determined DOC's post relief factor at the time to be 1.7 for a 7-day post and 1.2 for a 5-day post. Their recommendation was that we increase that, and their recommendation was based on best practices, and that we operate our relief factor at 1.72 for a 7-day post and 1.23 for a 5-day post. So it was a slight increase in its recommendation. That equated to those 33 positions we asked for and you gave us at a cost of approximately $5.6 million. Now, again, remember, this is a relief factor that hasn't been reviewed since the 90s. New or additional leave hours have been allotted to staff since we calculated that last, including additional training, as the slide talked about before, vacation days allotted, FMLA, the Oregon Family Leave Act, etc. Now, ASCA, when they were actually reviewing our operations, recommended the creation of additional posts to meet correctional best practices, to shore up those line of sight issues, and to ensure more safe and secure prisons. Now, that actually equated to more than the adjustment in the relief factor. That was a recommendation of 67 additional positions, which we asked for in the last budget development cycle, at the cost of about $11.4 million. Their hope in increasing those number of posts was to do exactly what the committee just started talking about minutes ago, create a safer, more secure prison and less stressful environment. Subsequent to ASCA's first report, DOC, we asked them to do a second review of our staff deployment, taking the newly established Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act audit standards in mind. And then in this report, they're actually requesting a few additional posts, which would require another 18 staff in order to meet that federal standard. So the committee talked about the impact on wellness. I know that it's obvious on its face, but you all know, because I've talked about you and talked about this individually when we meet in your office, we've talked about this on the record, staff wellness is of great concern to me. There are several issues we know with an outdated post-relief factor, but we especially know that it is a negative contributing factor to our staff's health. An inadequate post-relief factor, we know leads to high levels of mandatory overtime, leads to volunteer overtime, which compounds a really high stress environment. I believe I've shared this example with some of you, but I don't believe I've shared it with all of you. I remember speaking with one of my officers at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and this officer was relatively new to the position within a couple of years. He was fit and trim, he loved his job, and he approached me and was thanking me for our focus on staff wellness. And he was talking about all the things they were doing on the ground to kind of have a grassroots culture change around wellness, including getting out and walking around the facility on their breaks, talking about it at the water cooler, really changing the environment, creating programs inside the institution to support staff wellness. And he said, I really appreciate what the agency is doing. And he said, I personally believe that you, director, care about our well-being. And of course, I smiled, proud director. And then he said, but my wife doesn't believe you. And I said, okay, I'm listening. And he went on to explain that they had a young family, and at the beginning of the week, they plan their week and figure out who's picking up whom and who's dropping off whom and when. And I mess it up almost every week with either mandatory or volunteer overtime. And so we know that it's not just a wear and tear on their physical bodies. It is an issue that actually impacts family life as well. So what we see at the institution level is that staff, especially those who are new, and we were just talking about this in the hallway, they actually cannot take all of their vacation time because it's bid by security. And as a result, sometimes staff then call in sick on a day that they actually wanted to use a vacation day. But then there's this compounding issue, because then that's putting pressure on the staff who are there to either volunteer or be mandated for overtime. And it's this circle, this cycle that just continues, and I think really continues to compound the issues of staff wellness. As part of our wellness initiative during the 15-17 budget building process, we included the staff wellness package that included the positions that I mentioned earlier. So the 33 that you did approve, thank you again, to increase the relief factor. The 67 new positions in the amount of about $11.4 million that actually would create new posts throughout our agency. And then $0.2 million request for a centralized wellness coordinator position. While this POP package was not included in the governor's budget development cycle, the co-chairs did include that $33 million. And again, we are very grateful for that. The rest of this slide gives you an historical look at the asks we've made back, all the way going back to 2005 and 2007. And as you can see, our requests increased each biennium to match our growing need. So even though we don't have those additional positions that we asked for, we knew that as an agency we needed to do something to curb overtime in order to positively impact the wellness of our staff. So within existing resources, in order to combat this issue, we are concentrating on these areas, reducing our levels of overtime. There are some very innovative ideas that are happening inside our institutions around scheduling, around volunteer overtime as opposed to mandatory overtime that's happening throughout our organization. Really trying to manage overtime with volunteers rather than requiring overtime of staff that may not be in the position to give their best. But I will pause, even though I think that's a step in the right direction. I think that can still have a negative impact on these individuals. I think often we have young officers new to the position. They maybe don't have a family yet, or it's a young family. They're raring to go, and they volunteer for that overtime again and again and again. And two things happen. One, now they've created a financial income that their family is reliant on. The mortgage matches the overtime. The car matches the overtime. And then they're not 20 anymore, and they're mid-30s or late 30s, and the aches and pains or the mental wear and tear starts really degrading. And so while I'm glad that we're moving away from mandatory overtime to volunteer overtime, it still does not solve the problem in my mind. In addition, we'd also like to reduce our use of unplanned sick leave. I alluded to that just a few minutes ago, which would, I think it would do two things. One, it would indicate that our staff are both healthier and not resorting to using their sick leave when they get time off, when they need time off, and then also that they're actually getting their vacation time when they need it. And last, reducing health indicators that are induced by stress and chronic fatigue. Our top initiative is staff wellness, and I really believe if we begin to chip away at the unhealthy characteristics around working in corrections and create a more healthy environment, that some of these overtime issues are going to naturally go away as well because our staff will be coming to work. With that, this concludes my presentation regarding staffing levels, and I'm happy to answer any further questions that you might have.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In other budgets, DHS and OHA especially, we run into areas where we have inadequate staffing, such as the state hospital, some of our SACUs, and a bunch of other places you probably never heard of. We've been subject to lawsuits because of that, not only by the patients or the clients, but also by the federal government. Is there a risk here of inadequate staffing, of having a lawsuit brought against corrections or having inadequate staffing?
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, I appreciate the question. I think every day we're exposed legally to potential risks, there's no doubt, both by the inmate population and our staff. I will tell you that both AOCE and AFSCME have been incredible partners through the Great Recession. I think they've been very patient with our staffing levels and our increase in the inmate population, our increase in temporary and emergency beds. I will not speak for them at how long their patience will hold, but they have been really great partners during the Great Recession. I think we stand together in acknowledging the facts, but certainly, Senator, that risk is there.
Thank you. Just as a quick comment, we've lost most of those lawsuits and lost them pretty hard, so it's something we have to think of. Now, last question real quickly, you may know the answer. What is the percentage of payroll you're spending on overtime, and what does that number actually represent in dollars?
co-chairs and Senator Bates, that's actually a number I should have memorized, and I don't, but we will get that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Rayfield.
And then I was kind of curious, in looking at some of those numbers, it would seem to me from like an outsider's perspective, with the increasing stresses and things like that over time, that turnover might get greater with folks coming into this field. I mean, are there any numbers on that, or do you have a feel for that?
Co-chairs, specifically Representative Rayfield, we have looked at those numbers, and our turnover rate is not... it's not an outlier. And I think that's the thing that continues to impress me with the people that work inside of this organization. Because as many of you can attest who have stomped the halls of the prison and talked to staff, they love their jobs. They love their jobs and they want to make this a career, yet it's killing them. And so people are staying, and so we want them to stay and get healthy and stay healthy. And as we were talking about in the hallway earlier, and then, you know, my hope is that they retire early. We have PNF for a reason, and they get to utilize all of the PERS that you have all set out for them.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Have you looked at its subset of folks that have been there, say, 15 years, which are more likely to stay in, or have you looked at it, say, folks that just come in, new hires within the first 5 years, and whether that they have a higher turnover rate if, say, for the first 5 years than, say, other generations or in the past?
Co-chair, specifically Representative Rayfield, what we find is once they get past that seven-year mark, they stay. So if they're going to leave, it usually is before that seven-year mark. And we've also noted, and this is where I thought you were going, so I'll just mention it quickly, the stress level we've looked at in terms of tenure, too. And as you would suspect with anyone who has PTSD, as the time goes on, the stress level goes up. It's also correlated with the level of security. So the further you are inside one of my maximum security facilities, the more stress you're actually under.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is it, well, I don't know. We know that in law enforcement, we will frequently see agencies train up a person, they have them for a period of time, and then they leap over into another department. How is the competition between DOC and county corrections around the state? Does the county corrections perhaps pay more? I'm just looking at some of those variables.
Co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, it's definitely there. We definitely have individuals who get picked up by the county. Interestingly, it's just such a different environment that more often than not, those that started with us and go to the county come back. Because I think the people that are drawn to corrections are drawn to corrections because of that reformation and change and that ability to actually work with a population, where at the county jail it's very quick turnover. But for the record, yes, the counties pay more than we do. There's also dynamics on our borders. So often, since we pay more in Oregon than we do in Idaho, often people will sign on with the Idaho Department of Corrections and then join the Oregon Department of Corrections down the road. So there are some of those boundary, state boundary issues as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the next panel, just the first three. Please bring up Jeff Hernandez, Tim Woolery, and Valerie Stone. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Thank you. Co-chairs Rayfield, Shields, members of the committee, my name is Sergeant Jeffrey Hernandez. I am an 11-year sergeant at Oregon State Penitentiary at the Department of Corrections. I also have the privilege of representing the 900-plus correctional staff with the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. First of all, I can't thank Director Peters enough. I agree with everything she said, with one minor correction, which is an e-block at OSP from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. It's one corporal for up to 560 inmates. So we have others available, but it is a very large unit. So Deputy Peters, or excuse me, Director Peters was here to give you the business side, tell you about her people and her organization. I want to give you a face. I'm going to give you some names. We have, for years, been asked to do more with less, and we've done that. And we step up to that challenge. The people I work with, like Director Peters said, they want to be here, and they want to do a good job. We have growing mental health crises, and we have officers that go out of their way to read books with inmates, to play games with inmates, and to take the time to talk to them about visits. This takes away from the old idea of corrections of lock them up and go away. We don't do that anymore. The downside of that is it takes a lot more of our time and our energy and our mental well-being. Time that I could spend with my twin three-year-olds, I'm putting that mental energy into working with an adult in custody with the mentality of a three-year-old. And these are some of the challenges that I have to face each day. We also have a lack of skilled positions. You talked about retention, Representative Gorsuch. We have very skilled positions, not only just in the nursing staff and the electronic information security staff and the physical plant staff, but once you gain a number of years in security, you have skills that you can't gain from on the street. You have people skills, de-escalation skills, personal well-being skills, and identification skills. And these things can't be replaced easily. These officers want to stay. They want to keep practicing their art. And it becomes difficult when you start losing the well-being, not being able to take those vacation times. You also start seeing when people can't utilize their vacation time, you start seeing the increase of the sick time, like Director Peters said. We have banks of people with up to 300 hours of vacation time that they literally cannot use and have to spend it, they have to sell it back because we are not able to cover those positions. We have deaths in the institution, unexpected deaths. Sergeant Sean Harris, Corporal Robin Mathis, Officer Paul Patterson, and Officer Pancho Tavera died of cancer unexpectedly. And we went from their funeral back onto the tier doing our job. And staff that had vacation time, they could have used it to go and be with these people, did not get to do that. We had to go back and start working. We have high use of alcohol abuse, drug use. We have officers that go from being Officer Joel Beiler to inmate Joel Beiler, 1909-4709. Because he had a bad night with alcohol and had no way of relieving that stress. And he worked constantly because he had a new home, a new wife, and a new child. And the only way he had to get out, for in his mind, was alcohol use to relieve one night, and he became an inmate. And then we have the worst ones, Corporal Jake Easley, Corporal Larry Dodge, and Sergeant Chuck Peters, and Officer Robert McPherson, who took their own lives and left behind their families because they could not take the stress. And the environment and the alpha males and the alpha females and the leaders that we have don't take weakness. And these wellness programs that Director Peters is putting in place are addressing that. But when you can't ask the people that need you to be strong for help and you can't take the time to go and address your issues, sometimes people can't respond to that. And then we lose these officers and we lose these people. So those are some names that I wanted to hear, that I want out here. And these are some of the stresses that we deal with every day. I could tell you about being in large-scale disturbances where we go from standing in the dining room, feeding inmates like a normal day, to having 120 inmates being locked up, processed, because the fights constantly come over and over and over. I do 16 hours there, I go home and sleep for four, and then I come back and I do another 16 because we need to get the job done. Vacation is canceled. And then once that incident is lifted, the people that were involved don't have the ability to take a week off or even a day off. We go back to work. And we do this because we appreciate what we do and we appreciate the job responsibilities that we have. And I cannot thank you enough for the relief factor positions that you provided us with this last cycle. And I just wanted to give you that human face of some of these people that do this job. And they do it because they want to, not because they like the power, but because they like the position and what they're able to accomplish. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Stone.
I'll go next. Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee, my name is Tim Woolery. I actually work for the Oregon AFSCME Council 75 now. I was a correctional officer for about 18 years prior to this job. I've been doing this job about 10 years. I'm the lead negotiator for both the security unit, which is about 1,850 members right now, and the Security Plus unit, which is everybody else, the nurses, the counselors, physical plant, and that. And there's about 1,300 of those members that we represent. And I brought with me three correctional officers to share with you some more compelling testimony, such as Sergeant Hernandez just did with you. And I would like to once again thank not only Director Peters for her testimony today, but in the past, you know, I sit in and observe these hearings in my role and occasionally come up and talk to you to support staffing in particular, but many of the other issues that you all deal with, and we appreciate the work that you guys do. Last time you added 33 positions, and while that is a tremendous showing of support, it doesn't go anywhere near what we need. And so I brought these three other staff members that work in the Department of Corrections to share some of the stories with you, and the first one is Valerie.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Representative Rayfield and Senator Shields and committee. Thank you, Director Peters and Sergeant Hernandez and Mr. Woolery. They have given very good information and compelling information for you. My name is Valerie Stone. I am an officer at Sanium Correctional Institution here in Salem. I've been with the department for almost 14 years. I started at Coffee Creek as a brand new officer, ready to go. Over the years, I've realized just how difficult this job can be and how stressful it is, not just on myself, but on my family and friends that I work with. I'm also our ESS coordinator. I've been doing that for about 10 years, so that is a coordinator for our peer support. And peer support is really important to the whole wellness of our staff that we work with. We work in times of critical incidents. As Sergeant Hernandez has mentioned, you know, we lose staff every day, and we have lost so many staff, really good staff here. Staff assaults, suicide, family illnesses, chronic fatigue, you know, it's the wear and tear of this job every single day that brings us to a new baseline of where we are, and we never get to go back to the way we were. That's our new baseline for the rest of our lives. And that's a new baseline for our children and families. In this high stress environment, you know, our constant overtime and working constantly daily for vacations and through sick time. To put an idea on how that works, our smaller institutions, you know, have a unique problem with our staffing levels. I worked out at South Fork, and their staffing levels are 4, 4, and 3 to manage a population of 150 men out in the middle of the Tillamook Forest, where emergency response is about 30 minutes away. And when our staff are gone on sick leave or training, you know, our graveyard staffing levels might go down to 2. And getting somebody to come in and stay for that next shift so that we have at least a minimum standard can be very difficult. And I, as a developmental, had an opportunity to work. I myself had to stay over and work those positions so that we were fully staffed and that our staff are safe and our adults in custody are also safe.
Just explained, she mentioned she was in a developmental. She was actually working in a management job.
And could you, again, management. Identify yourself for the record?
Tim Woolery, you're going to ask me. She was working a developmental position as a manager because there was a hole for, there was not enough managers. And so she was given the opportunity to develop herself. But as that position, she's not supposed to then fill in for the representative people. We're supposed to have enough representative people to do those things. So it just shows we don't have enough staff. And I didn't know that by what she said that you understood she was actually filling a management role that had to then stay and work in one of our positions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Get a little tongue tied.
No problem.
But when we have staff living also very far from where we work, especially on the east side of the state, our homes are sometimes 60 minutes away from where we work. So if we're mandatoried and stay over for that 8 hours, we are on a 2-hour drive just to and from work. So now our batteries only get a 6-hour opportunity to recharge, but that's only after we've picked up the kids or done the grocery shopping or any of the other chores that we have. And to come back the next day, prepped and ready to go and be able, with our vigilance, to do our job effectively and safely, it becomes dangerous, and that wear and tear over the years becomes a problem. And to mitigate that, our department is working on staff wellness and trying to create a better environment so that we are paying attention to our mental health and physical health. And so having more staff to help us, that ripple effect that comes from the sick time and the call-ins, you know, bringing our staffing up will be a good place to start. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Rayfield, hold on.
And Sergeant Hernandez,
yes, sir.
And I forget, Ms. Stone, or yes. Deputy Stoner. I guess I just had a couple questions. We talked about the high overtime, and I was, and you had mentioned, like, there's times where you've only got 6 hours between shifts. I'm kind of curious, you know, in a given, like, this past year, I mean, how much, you know, in a given week, you know, how much overtime are you putting in? I mean, obviously, your families are making a tremendous sacrifice. especially, sorry, I mean, you have, you know, twins, so I mean, it's very impressive. You have obviously an amazing wife, but I'm just kind of curious, you know, what does that look like for you and your families?
Co-chair, specifically, co-chair, Representative Rayfield. I at one point in time, I was working between 60 hours of overtime to 98 hours of overtime, I believe, in 1 month period after my children were born, because we don't have enough scheduling and my wife is working another post. I actually saw her this morning. Today is my day off. And I saw her this morning. She came back from interviewing actually for an ESS position to join peer support for no extra money. And she came home and I said, I need to get ready to go and testify. And she said, well, it's nice to see you this week. And that's almost a legitimate that statement. I will not see her tomorrow because I attend the Corrections Policy Committee at DPSST to try and make things better for our correctional staff as well. And these are things I do that other people do in their own way at the institution. At Oregon State Correctional Institution, my understanding is that on some of the swing shift and graveyard posts, because of the staffing levels and the amount of flexes that are available, the flex officers that are not assigned to a static post, but are instead there to be utilized for sick leave call-in and overtime prevention. The way the staffing, what we are allowed to have, some people are being mandatory 3 to 4 times a month. I know when I was working in special housing and disciplinary segregation, we had one particular officer that worked at the second tier that, due to the way the scheduling was and the hours, and the administration, when it became noticeable, they did respond. So this is not the fault. I'm not trying to place blame on the institution. However, because of the posting and the amount of people that we had available, he was almost guaranteed to be mandatory every week if no one took that voluntary overtime. And we have developed a culture at Oregon State Penitentiary and Oregon State Correctional Institution, and I'm quite sure Sandy M and the other institutions that you hear from, where when we start hearing, the radio will come out and an officer will say, there's overtime available from these hours. If no one volunteers to take it, mandatories will follow. And that's when we start finding out who has mandatories. Sergeant Harrison Branch, his wife just developed breast cancer, and he doesn't have the ability to do overtime because he needs to be home for her at Oregon State Penitentiary. Yet he's on top of the mandatory list every time. And when his number comes up, there's a number of people that step up and break their own hours, that break their own home life, so that he can go home and take care of this critical need for his wife that she needs right in these early stages of her disease. And this is what we do to each other. And what we would like to have is to have these extra people available so that we don't have to do this, so that we have the option of going home, so that I can take my three-year-old children to the Gilbert House and play with them instead of coming home and kissing their heads while they're asleep and then waking up at 4:30 the next morning to be at work at 5:30, which is the other part of our culture. My shift starts 6 to 2, and I try to get there at 5:30 a.m. so the person can go home a little bit early, and then return. They come in about half an hour early to do that. It's one of these culture things that we set up, and this is one of the ways we support each other as correctional officers, and one of the ways that I know Director Peters and Director Brokamp are trying to ask you for help so that we can take some of this burden off and become healthier, better people. Thank you for your question very much, sir.
Thanks, I appreciate it. We're going to need to move on. Can we bring up Paul McDonough and Greg Clouser?
And my apologies to your wife, just so you know, and thank you for being here today. So,
thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
So he took that chair's wife first.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Shields and Representative Rayfield, my name is Corporal Clouser. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. I had a cold this week, so excuse my voice. I'd like to thank, of course, everyone that, of course, testified before us. And you'll have to forgive me. As you said, Senator Bates, I would rather stand in a day room with 100 inmates than sit here and talk before the 7 or 8 of you. just so you know, that's my life. I started with the Oregon Department of Corrections in 2000. I've been working for Oregon now for 16 years. As I said, I'm a corporal. I work at Two Rivers Correctional Institution. It's about an 1,800-bed medium facility in Umatilla, Oregon. Over the last many years, overtime has basically, as you have heard, it's a way of life. You can talk to my daughter. She will tell you that we have what's called the bucket list, which is the mandatory list. At the age of 5, you could talk to her, and she could tell you what it was, how it worked, and how her dad wouldn't come home. It doesn't matter what you planned, where you're at, or what you need to do. It ultimately always seems that the day you have to go to your daughter's recital, a baseball game, or something, you get bucketed. And as the sergeant said, yes, we do, and I have many times. In fact, 4 days ago, Officer Horn was bucketed. He had things to do with his kids. I had already worked a 16-hour the day before. That night I worked 16 again so that he could go home to his family. Let's see here. This year we had 3 staff members, and, you know, for me, I like to bring things that are real as well as others. This year, we had 3 staff members that were bucketed on Christmas from what we call second shift to third shift. So they worked 6:50 a.m. to 11 o'clock p.m. Christmas Day. We had a few people that did help them. There were several that did volunteer to help, but we had 3. Myself and 4 others were mandated on New Year's Day this year. So we again worked 6:50 a.m. to 11 p.m. New Year's. These are things we do every day. We do them because we have to, and we do them because it's our job. I have, as you asked, Representative Rayfield, I did bring some numbers for you today. I wasn't sure if they would be needed or not, but last month at Two Rivers Correctional Institution, we have approximately 200, and I am the local president there. I have been for several years. So I have 272 officers, corporals, and sergeants that work at Two Rivers. Last month, 231 of us worked overtime for a total of 3,398 hours. Now, for each of us, we work a month, that's 168 hours. You divide that by the 3,398, that's 20 staff members that we covered last month that we don't have. You've also heard testimony on the bucket list, how we get to the top and we rotate to the bottom. As in the other day, I was number 1. People didn't come in, or we had a sick leave, we have vacation, we have trainings, things that are mandated. So we have people that need to stay. On the 6th, which was just 2 days ago on Saturday, I have what's called our bucket list, which is the mandatory list that we go through. On our, let me find it here. From graveyard to day shift, which graveyard has about 20 staff members that work at Two Rivers, we had 15 individuals that stayed either voluntary or mandatory. From day shift to swing shift, we had 33 individuals that had to stay to cover the shift from swing shift to from day shift to swing shift. From swing shift then into graveyard again that same day, we had another 16 individuals that had to stay to meet those standards. So in one 24-hour period, we had 64 individuals out of 270 that stayed to work overtime. That's not something that's rare. That's normal every day for me and Mr. McDonough. I've skipped around a little on my report here, so I will look and see what I have maybe forgotten or not. But that's pretty much what I had to say. Thank you guys, honestly, for allowing me to come down and to talk to you today. If you have any questions, or I would also give any of you the opportunity, as Senator Bates, I am the local president at Two Rivers. At any time, please come take a tour of our institution, talk to our staff members. We would well welcome that. Thank you.
Good testimony. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Chair, Shields, co-chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. Name's Paul McDonough. I've worked for the department for 17 years. I'm currently assigned to the transport unit. I work out of Umatilla, Oregon. I've done that for 10 years. The transport unit, we have 61 full-time officers and sergeants that are required to basically oversee all the movement of the inmates in the state of Oregon and also in the United States. We take them to other facilities, whether we go rent beds from other states to move inmates, bring them back to Oregon. We're also in charge of taking them out on med trips, court appearances, scheduled med trips, emergency med trips, funerals. They get a visitation. They pay for it. We take them out to funerals to give their last, you know, visitation with their relatives. Oftentimes, we are forced to work outside the policies and procedures of the department. One example is we have custody levels that we assign to the inmates, level 3 and below. We only are required to send one staff with that person, with the inmate, out on med trips. Oftentimes, they go for hours, and we are, at least an hour. Our closest hospital is 10 minutes away. We don't use hardly, a lot of them are at least 60 miles away. During that time, if a staff member has to use the bathroom, we've been instructed to notify our lieutenant that we have to use the bathroom and leave the inmate alone in a room by themselves. These rooms are not clean. They are not, they have needles. Used needles, knives, any of that stuff could be in this room, and we've been instructed to leave them alone. That's, well, once we walk out that room, now they're by themselves. They could leave. They could escape. They could take somebody hostage. Anything can happen. That leaves not only the staff member coming back into the situation at risk, but also the general public. The liability it puts on the department is huge. I wouldn't want to be the officer to have to make that phone call to my supervisor saying, he's gone. You know? That's not something I want to do. Another issue that we have are we're required to take the inmates out on med trips. If we don't have enough staffing in transport, in my office alone we have 12 staff. We take care of EOCI, which is in Pendleton, Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution, and Two Rivers with 12 staff. If we don't have enough staffing to take the inmate out, we have to go back to the institution and say, we need staff, thus making their bucket somebody forced to work overtime to accomplish this med trip so the department doesn't get sued. We mandatory somebody on overtime to allow them to work. When this happens, if they've made plans to go to activities, now they have to change those plans. They're going to miss their child's basketball game, wrestling, Christmas, dance recitals, any of that stuff. There was one time I worked overtime on a med trip that was scheduled for 2 hours. We get on the trip. It's to Richland, Washington. All of a sudden, it turns to an emergency. Now this guy has to be life-flighted to OHSU in Portland. We call Columbia River for relief staff because I'm on the east side of the state. Columbia River, which is in Portland, takes over the med trip at that time. They say, well, we don't have anybody to come relieve you. It's going to be 6 o'clock in the morning. Mind you, I started at 6 o'clock in the morning. So before they can get any relief staff, I'm already, by the time I get relieved and get home, I've worked more than 24 hours. I have to stay awake this whole time. I can't leave. I'm the only one at the hospital with this inmate. It's hard to do our job with the amount of staff we have and keep the public safe. And yet we do it. We have amazing staff in the department.
I just have a quick question.
A couple of quick questions because I really want to get through the rest of the agenda. Okay.
Absolutely.
And so you had mentioned you're working for 24 hours straight. And are you driving at some point within that 24-hour period?
On the way back, I would drive, yes. Half the way usually is what we do. We drive halfway to the Dalles and the other person takes over. It's been a couple years now. I believe I did drive for about an hour and a half when I finally said, I can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just really briefly, when you're making the local trips, do you have the ability, you have radio contact with local law enforcement?
We have it in Oregon, not in Washington.
Okay.
We do when we take our higher custody inmates out, we do what we have, a trip slip that notifies the area agencies that we are in the area. But yeah, if I go into Washington, I have no radio contact with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. We really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Yes, you guys.
All right, Linda, tell us where we are and where we're going.
The next item on your agenda is a work session, and this is a report on prison population, the status of the population. It will be similar to reports you have heard before, required by budget note throughout the interim. Director Peters.
Should I open the work session?
Yes.
So I will open a work session on the topic of prison population and status report. Director Peters. And again, keeping in mind, I would like to get both agenda items done by 2:30.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Colette Peters, director of the Department of Corrections, and have with me Dustin Ball from BAM and our CFO, Steve Robbins. I will begin with time in mind, but first would like to publicly say thank you to the members from AFSCME and AOCE who just gave great testimony. I get to spend a lot of time with you all telling you how amazing my team is, and you got to see it live, so thank you. As you know, during the 15-17 session, we received a budget note from all of you requiring us to report regularly on the female population. You also know, you've heard this story a couple of times now, since we're required to report out regularly, that in October we actually became concerned with the male population and the increase from that perspective. As I testified before you in January, based on the housing capacity for the female population at Coffee Creek, we have been saying that we are recommending the activation of OSP minimum when that number gets to 1,280. Now, we've been there, and the forecast, though, is calling for a reduction in those numbers, which means that's why we're not calling for the activation of OSP minimum. Today, like our testimony in January, we are still relying on that October forecast. While I look at that email every morning at 5:26 a.m. to see what our count is, we're still making business decisions based on that October forecast. While the forecast shows the population will exceed the threshold in 2016, as I said, it is forecasted to dip under the threshold until 2020. So while during January legislative days we reported that the actual female population has consistently exceeded the October 2015 forecast by as many as 50 women, it has generally held to 10 or fewer over the forecast. We're still hoping to accommodate the short period of growth within existing resources at Coffee Creek. We also haven't seen the anticipated impact of the family sentencing alternative pilot, which just came live in January. So we're also optimistic about that. So based solely on the October 2015 forecast, which we hope holds, OSPM will not need to be activated until March 2020. The male population. The October 15 prison population forecast does differ greatly from the April forecast. The dip that was projected to go away in the male population was eliminated in the October forecast. Given that, we had to come up with a housing plan. As you recall, going back my testimony in January, also in November, the plan is to shift the current adults in custody who are in the minimum institution at Deer Ridge and shift those to the medium facility. That's literally moving about 787 individuals across the parking lot into the medium facility where we will run it and staff it as a minimum. The minimum will no longer house inmates. We will keep it open for program space, including some space for Oregon Corrections Enterprise. That shift alone costs approximately $2.5 million, but it prepares us for the need to activate additional beds. Opening the next incremental phase would actually cost us an additional $7 million. We continue to be optimistic. You know how committed we are to the justice reinvestment conversation. And that being said, I will note one other thing before I stop with this agenda item and mention that based on the October 15 forecast, we need to remember that Junction City has moved back inside that 10-year window. So I remain optimistic, and I hope that the work at the county level pushes that back out 10 years. Otherwise, we will be talking about Junction City in this next budget development cycle. With that, I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Krieger.
Nationally, the economy seems to be stalling down. There was only 150,000 jobs last month created. Is there any information from that movement of opportunity for employment that's going to affect how people react and get themselves involved in illegal activity?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, I have not heard a connectivity between those two. I have read research reports that sort of break the urban myth that when the economy drops, crime goes up. So I know that research exists, but I haven't seen anything lately based on those projections.
Thank you. Thanks. Representative Wisnett, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the report from the corrections.
Is that sufficient?
That's sufficient.
All right. Representative Wisnett has moved acceptance of the report. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved, and I'll close the work session on the prison population status report. Thank you very much. Now we will move into the informational meeting, which we do not necessarily need a quorum for.
We do.
To begin it?
To begin it.
All right.
Yes.
Can we go searching for me? We'll stand at ease.
Do you have a quorum for information?
Population shift. Please proceed.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, again for the record, this is Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and I'm here today to request appropriation of just over $2.5 million in general fund for the purpose of shifting the population from the Deer Ridge Correctional Institution minimum custody facility to the medium custody facility, as I just mentioned in the population report. And then, if and only if it becomes necessary, requesting an additional $6.9 million in general fund to staff the facility to utilize 200 additional beds to accommodate the anticipated population growth. This shift in expansion is projected to be needed based on the October 2015 Office of Economic Analysis prison population forecast. The DOC 1517 legislatively adopted budget caseload is based on the April 15 prison population forecast. Based on those estimates, the male population forecast indicated that it would be necessary to open the medium facility at Deer Ridge not until July 2019. So when I talked earlier about dramatic shift between those two forecasts, it's represented in those numbers. The October 15 forecast really did differ greatly, projecting the need for an additional 200 male beds by March 2016, which, as you well know, is around the corner. While this past week we have seen our actual population fall below the October forecast, that's where my optimism gets to come out, it is important to reiterate that our current budget is based on the April 15 forecast, and the actual population continues to exceed that, which we were budgeted for, by between 50 and 140 inmates over the past few months. At the November 2015 Justice Reinvestment, the convening of counties that we had meeting at DPSST, the Criminal Justice Commission reported that this increase is primarily due to three factors. One, diminishing impacts from 3194. Two, slightly longer than average estimated length of stay. And three, fewer intakes with an estimated short length of stay of 0 to 12 months. So I talked about how previous plans called for keeping the Deer Ridge minimum facility open and incrementally opening beds in the medium. That would have cost us substantially more. That would have cost us approximately $56 million. So really understanding the importance of justice reinvestment is why we came forward with this alternative to shift the inmates from one prison to the other at a significantly lower cost. The plan is to shift, as I said, all of those inmates, but it comes at a cost of $2.5 million, which I said will position us should we need to open the additional beds the forecast predicts we will need. As I have committed to you, as I have committed to my public safety partners, those that are here today in support of justice reinvestment, that we are here today asking for that appropriation only if we need it following session, not that we're planning on expanding those beds today. So I thank you for your consideration of that request, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
Superintendent, is there anything more that we can do on the side of the legislature to help along that process of influencing maybe sentencing and some other things? Are there things that we can do for that? I mean, I realize we can't tell DAs what to do and we can't tell the DAs what to do, but is there anything more that we could do?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Gorsuch, I think the support that we've received from this committee around justice reinvestment has been fabulous, both from your participation from passing 3194, but also the conversations that you're having with your local DAs, your local judges, the chiefs and the sheriffs. I think that's really where your help is needed the most in having those conversations, asking your local county, what do your numbers look like? How are you utilizing justice reinvestment? How much are you utilizing your prison beds? The Criminal Justice Commission just turned on a webpage that actually allows you to go and look at each county and how it's utilizing prison beds. So you can actually have access to that data in real live time. And I think it's those conversations that really are driving that forward motion. I think the commitment that we have from every county, almost without exception, is high. I think they all want the same thing. And so for me, it's the complicated piece, Representative, is that in the meantime, we're dancing on a razor's edge.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Bates.
My question's about timing here. We're going to be leaving session no later than March 5th. And if something happens between March 5th and late January of next year, 17, I mean, how much time would it take to open that up, to physically open it up, and how fast would you have to spend the money? Give me some idea of what could happen over while we're gone.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, I can turn it over to my CFO for a more detailed time period, but that's why we are here today, is because it takes time. And so we believe that the shift needs to happen now, and the plan is that it happens before month's end so that we are then prepared, because it does take time to hire the staff and to make those operational on-the-ground adjustments to happen. I know that it has taken us months to get to this point, probably towards from the end of October till the end of February, even to get to the place where we can make the shift happen. Mr. Robbins, anything you'd like to add to that?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Robbins, the CFO for the Department of Corrections. I wouldn't really modify the director's answer there other than to say that we have already been in the process of preparing for the shift, so that component is already taken care of. However, we're looking at doing this in multiple phases if it's necessary. The second phase absolutely requires more staff than this initial shift, and the staffing and bringing them on board and getting them through the initial training process, that is what takes time. So right now we're operating much like we would be for the opening of the minimum at OSP. It's about a 6-month time frame for us to really get up and moving, which is why it's for us, we talk about a razor's edge. That's where we are right now. But we understand that discretion is in order. So that's why we're trying very hard to do it just with the shift at this point.
All right. Anything else? Oh, Representative Krieger.
Just curiously, you open a new facility and say you need 250 new people, whatever it is. Do you shift existing ones in so you don't have all new people there? Even though they go through the academy, they get trained. And then how Is that a mandatory shift?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, it is not a mandatory shift, but you're picking up on a great nuance. We will have many individuals who will ask to transfer to Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, and we've had many folks inside our agency who have been waiting for that medium to open so that they could make that transfer. So the reality is that the new cadets will actually be pulled in likely into the valley to fill those positions from which people transferred to Deer Ridge.
Thank you.
So, Senator Bates.
School chair, I just want to be sure I'm clear of the process here. We're talking about looking at this from the point of view of the omnibus bill at the end of this four-week session or five-week session, including in that budget one way or the other. So we have to make a decision with that with the big co-chair as well as ourselves. Am I understanding this correctly?
You are.
Okay. And I assume, since I'm not a chair of this particular committee, I'm chair of two others, that discussion is going on? And so the deferral word I see here is not deferring this. It's saying we're going to look at this budget and make a decision by the end of the month.
We're rounding in on a recommendation of a combination of a direct appropriation, a special purpose appropriation, and then a balance that's left. And so it's just a matter of honing in on specifically what those dollars are, and they will be in the close of session bill.
If you did a SPA, it sounds to me like they need the money right now to make this transition and get it rolling. The SPA could be released by the emergency board, I assume.
That's correct.
But again, that would be potentially be a delay. From what we heard in the testimony here, unless other information is available, I'm not a chair here, but I would recommend that we make it part of the omnibus bill and avoid the SPA, because if we're checking the number of inmates we have every morning and we suddenly have a jump in July or August, we could be in trouble getting the money to them, or they wouldn't be able to even spend the money to get the job. I just want to get that on the record.
Anything else? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Linda, anything you want to tee up for us?
Now we are going to the report on, or the information on the behavioral health unit.
Okay.
Another funding request.
Fire away.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, again, for the record, I am Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and I'm here today, last and certainly not least, to discuss the work the Department of Corrections is undertaking in collaboration with Disability Rights Oregon to improve the management of and provision of services and treatment to our most seriously mentally ill population. I had the privilege, alongside Bob Jundeff, who's here today in the audience, of Disability Rights Oregon, to present before the Joint House and Senate Judiciary Committees during January legislative days, and I know some of you were in the room for that conversation, to discuss their concerns and our collaborative efforts to resolve these concerns. So, in addition to all of our other requests today, we are also requesting $8.2 million in general fund for the purposes of reducing isolation and improving the care of our seriously mentally ill adults in custody in the behavioral health unit at our Oregon State Penitentiary. As a bit of background, I shared with the Joint Judiciary Committees, while I am here today to discuss changes to BHU and the Department of the Department of Corrections is really proud of our history, and we've always hoped to engage in that continuous improvement for our agency generally, but certainly for this population. And it goes back at least to 2003 with the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, which was created to address specific issues related to the delivery of mental health services to Oregonians. DOC then worked with clinical and community stakeholders to make changes. The Department of Corrections implemented many of those recommendations. We created the specific mental health housing units. Before that, the mentally ill were in a mix of general population. We began instituting the use of step-down units to more smoothly transition inmates who were in a mental health crisis back into the general population. We've been providing staff training, not just to our counseling staff and our mental health staff, but to our frontline security staff to understand this population even more. And, of course, updating policies and procedures. That task force recommendations really put us on a glide path toward a purpose-built facility to house both the mentally ill and medically infirmed in Junction City. So Junction City has always been part of our long-term plan to help with this population. You heard me testify just moments ago with great hope that we push the construction of Junction City out of the 10-year window. And so, as such, DOC's current mental health configuration is really the result of incremental and intermediate temporary steps toward that goal. Now that we are hoping we don't need Junction City, this conversation with Disability Rights Oregon became even more imperative. So I want you to know that we have a long-standing, positive, and collaborative relationship with Disability Rights Oregon. As you know, they're the state's federally designated protection and advocacy system. A memorandum of understanding has actually been in place with this organization for years, granting them access to our facilities, access to records, access to staff, and immediate access to inmates. In August of 2014, they contacted us, letting us know that they had some concerns in our behavioral health unit and that they would be engaging in an investigation. Now, the behavioral health unit is an intensive behavior management and skills training unit for the adults that are in our custody with serious mental illness who have also committed violent acts or disruptive behavior. So in May 2015, Disability Rights Oregon issued a report, which I know you have all seen. And while we did not agree with all of their findings and conclusions, we really did welcome the opportunity to have them focus on improvements and focus on ways that we can improve the treatment of the adults who are in our care. Now, unlike other states that elected to engage in costly, protracted litigation before agreeing to reform, we instead conducted a comprehensive review alongside DRO on BHU that included a consultation with a nationally recognized expert who really opened our eyes to ways to do things inside that old structure that really are progressive. So following that review, DOC and DRO engaged in discussions together on how to improve that unit. Those results came through and are incorporated into a new memorandum of understanding. I provided a copy of that MOU for your review, so I won't go over it in great detail, especially since I see there are 2 minutes left, Senator Shields. But I will tell you that among the improvements, DOC is committed, if funding is available, to changes that will allow these individuals who are assigned to the BHU significantly more out of cell time. In fact, we are looking at an average of 10 hours per week out of cell for programming and treatment, and another 10 hours out of cell for unstructured activities. We will also provide enhanced access to mental health services and give greater consideration to individual mental health treatment needs. These improvements will come at a cost. We are talking about architectural changes, operational changes, and staffing changes that will come at a cost. The major improvements for which we are requesting include moving one housing unit with the intermediate care housing unit inmates into E-Block, which I mentioned earlier, to improve the process of stepping down adults in custody into general population, while also we made that move so that we can create more space for the treatment teams near the existing behavioral health unit. We also are proposing constructing a purpose-built modular structure adjacent to the BHU building to accommodate treatment space and offices for increased mental health staff. We also would like to increase security, mental health, and medical staffing to accommodate that additional out-of-cell time. Now, even without additional funding, we want you to know that we are committed to these efforts, and we've already begun making some immediate improvements to BHU. For example, we removed the window louvers from inside the recreation area, which once we removed those metal louvers, the sunlight into that rec area increased dramatically. We brought in new recreation equipment. We are now providing musical instruments for them to check out, and we've expanded the unit library. And I really believe that these changes will have a domino effect on the rest of our special housing. I have already seen firsthand the positive changes with our immediate care housing unit when we moved that to E-Block and engaged in the structural changes that we gave in it is clearly a more normalized environment. There's more light. There's now a day room for those individuals. There are now inmate mentors on that unit. There are dining tables on the unit so they can recreate and dine together on the unit. So I believe that these changes aren't just about BHU. I think they will encourage a growth in our culture amongst staff as well. And I think this is a great example of small changes making really big impacts down the road. As you are aware, we are also awarded a grant that is allowing the Vera Institute to analyze all of our special housing and develop recommendations for its safe reduction. The work we are doing is in line with DROE and in line with President Obama's recent remarks around solitary confinement. So I'd like to conclude by calling attention to the fact that this request for funding is unlike DOC's other requests that are dependent on forecasts and actual populations. We typically attempt to break requests down into phases and provide multiple options for you. This project is different in that it's either an all or nothing. Either we create the new space to house the new staff we're proposing, or we don't create the new space and we don't ask for the staff. It's kind of an all or nothing move forward. But it's costly. The cost of the project is estimated to be $8.2 million, of which just over $2.9 million is one-time startup costs. So the rest of that is staffing that will go over future biennia. So that's the conclusion of my remarks. I want to thank you for considering this request, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. At some point, if Disability Rights Oregon wants to testify in front of this committee, we would welcome that testimony. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
And this meeting is adjourned.